This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. On July 20th, 1969, millions of people around the world were captivated by the Apollo 11 lunar landing.
Armstrong is on the moon. Neil Armstrong, 38-year-old American, standing on the surface of the moon on this July 20th, 1969.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
And on that day, a 9-year-old boy from southern Ontario was inspired by Neil Armstrong, Michael Collins, and Buzz Aldrin and decided he was going to be an astronaut. That boy was Chris Hadfield, who you may know from his series of tweets and YouTube videos created during his 5 months on the International Space Station. The tweets featured pictures from outer space. They included wildfires on Earth and other beauties that can only be seen from way up there. And his videos answer those questions we all have about an astronaut's life in space.
Techmi from B-Town, Ontario asked, is it challenging to brush your teeth in space without getting toothpaste up your nose from weightlessness?
That's what I want to know. We're gonna get that answer eventually. Chris Hadfield came back to Earth for good in May of 2013. His resume includes 3 space missions, 2 spacewalks, and logged nearly 4,000 hours in space. Chris Hadfield is the author of the book, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth. It's now out in paperback. He's in North Carolina for a book signing at Raleigh's Quail Ridge Books tonight at 7 o'clock. And first, he joins us on the State of Things. Colonel Hadfield, welcome. Good to have you here.
It is a delight to be here, and I have no toothpaste up my nose.
Okay, well, then that answers that question. We can move on. Take us back to 1969, that landing. What were you thinking?
I grew up on a farm, and my parents really encouraged not just curiosity, but curiosity answered. You know, that we had an Encyclopedia Britannica at home, and every dinnertime conversation when somebody came, it was like our internet at the time. You know, someone had a question, one of us would toddle over out of the 5 kids and grab the book and look things up. And I was a big, fan of science fiction and Star Trek and 2001 A Space Odyssey. But underpinning it all at the time was the reality of the first. It wasn't even a decade old yet. People were leaving Earth, Gagarin and then Al Shepard. And it all sort of came to a little 9-year-old boy's fantasy and reality simultaneously when Cronkite was narrating that walk on the moon. And to me, that was like some older statesman opening a door and saying, this is possible. There are impossible things actually coming true right now. And it's like an invitation to you. What do you want to do with your life? And so for me, it was just the stuff of dreams.
The invitation is one thing. Imagining yourself out there is one thing. And then there's doing something about it. And apparently, when I read your book, you started doing something about it, right?
Well, you know, that's where life occurs, is in between imagination and what you choose to do next. And so as a little kid just turning 10, I was inspired by what I'd seen, and even more so maybe, Frank, by looking up at the moon itself. And the moon hadn't changed, but boy, my perception of it sure had, and the accessibility had. But I realized even then that, Publishers Clearinghouse wasn't going to phone me and say, you are going to be an astronaut. That's not how it works.
Right.
You have to turn yourself into what it is you're dreaming about.
What were you doing? Well, yeah, what'd you
and
do?
So, I'm a little kid, and I'm from Canada. Canada had no astronaut program. It wasn't like I could phone NASA. You know, it was forbidden and unavailable. But that morning, walking on the moon had been forbidden and unavailable. And so I thought, that's a worthwhile thing in life. That's an interesting, virtually impossible long-term dream, but I'm going to start trying to turn myself into someone who might be able to do that. And so what do you do when you're 10 years old? I read about it. I learned to snorkel, and then I learned to scuba dive. I joined an organization called Air Cadets to learn to fly, and I started flying gliders at 14 and powered airplanes at 15. I took a year off after high school. I was like tired of school. I thought, well, what do I really want to do? But during that year off, bumming around the world, I resolved this is what I want to do. And so I came back and joined the Air Force and became a fighter pilot, then a test pilot. Went to a couple universities in Canada and then University of Tennessee. And then it was a test pilot with the Air Force out at Edwards up in the desert of California, up on the Rogers Dry Lake bed, which was amazing. And then test pilot in Maryland with the Navy, did a tour. And out of all of that, amazingly enough, finally somebody did phone my house and say, do you want to be an astronaut? And I said yes.
You know, it's interesting. I've read testimonies from other test pilots in particular, people who started out in the space program, and they kind of hated it as test pilots. They, like, a lot of those guys didn't make the transition because they said, well, wait a minute. This is kind of like not flying an airplane. This is kind of – that's kind of boring.
My brother is a pilot, a brother Dave. He's 2 years older than I am, and he was one of those guys – he just wanted to fly. That's all he had model airplanes hanging from the ceiling. He built, he memorized, he knew he could look at a picture. It was like a contest. I can recognize that airplane in 1 millisecond. That was just what he always dreamed about. I always wanted to fly, but the verb was not the end game. I wanted to fly so that I could fly in space. And so it was different for me. My end game wasn't to be a pilot and then a test pilot. All of those were fascinating. But I was really hoping that they would take me higher.
They did in 1995. You finally figured out that snorkeling and scuba diving was the wrong direction. Up you go in 95. Tell us about that. You finally get to space.
Yeah, it was 26 years after Neil and Buzz had walked on the moon. And since I'd made that decision, and until that morning at the Kennedy Space Center down in Florida, I was laying on my back inside Space Shuttle Atlantis, up on the flight deck, sitting next to Bill MacArthur from North Carolina, the two of us together and a crew of five. And as hyper aware as five human beings can be of completely existing in the moment, because if you're about to pilot a rocket ship, nothing you've ever done in your life matters, and nothing that's going to happen more than 10 minutes from now matters. Everything that you have needs to be focused on the next second and the next 10 minutes of your life, because the power is unbelievable, and the speed with which things can go wrong is unprecedented, and you have a huge part in whether you're going to get to orbit safely or not. So it's an amazing 10 minutes that takes you from what you've been dreaming about for the last quarter century into a place that is almost brand new in the human existence, and it happens in the time it takes to order a meal and sit down in a restaurant.
You are a rare group of humans, you who have been in space, in the sense that you are probably the most tested in every way, physically and emotionally and psychologically, among us. I can't imagine that there are many professions that do as much testing, particularly that psychological testing, right? I mean, is this person going to be able to make it through that pressure or crack?
It's like you're a perpetual little pebble going through the ultimate filter to become an astronaut. It's what you sort of feel like. And you hope that the mesh of the filter doesn't at some point spit you off into a side tray. That's sort of how it feels. And as you say, part of it's medical and psychological. A lot of it is you know, you're evaluated every day for 20 years as an astronaut in the simulators, in all the things you do. The psychological side, you know, all of those standard hyphenated tests that you take that, you know, when I was a child, I used to always answer the door first. And yes or no. I'm going, geez, I don't even know what the right answer is here.
Yeah. Well, I wondered about that. See, how, because at a certain point, you get what they're going for. I mean, if you're smart enough to be, you know, do this, then you're smart enough to figure out where they're going. So, like, can you cheat?
So when they went through astronaut, well, I'm a big believer in winning games. And yeah. And to me, that was sort of part of it. So what do you do? So there was no internet, so I couldn't like look up things. So I called a couple psychiatrist friends of mine and said, how do you do well on these tests? What are they looking for? And then there were, you know, fill in the blanks tests, like, you know, when I was younger, I used to always. And then fill it in, or after making love, he, and then there's a blank, and you know, it's like, gosh, what am I supposed to write in those? So I studied, I talked to the people that were expert, I tried to understand what people were looking for, I tried to get myself ready, and then I tried to do it as well as I could. And really, that's true for a psychological exam, but it's kind of how I've conducted my entire life, And luckily enough, as a result of all that, they found me sane enough but also competent enough to fly in space three times.
See, I always figure anybody who's smart enough to make that kind of preparation, I'd let them fly. That's the deal, even if they did kind of peek at the answers. So, yeah. But now, so the toothpaste question we laugh at. I'm going to ask you the same question, essentially, in terms of its silliness, but it really matters to me. You walked in space. And every time I see those pictures of those guys tethered by that umbilical to this thing that's in space, and the announcer's always telling me how fast it's going, and then there's no sense of motion,
right.
And you're kind of high, but really you're not because you can't fall. All right, here's my question, dumb as it is. What's it like to walk in space?
I've done two spacewalks. I've been outside of a spaceship for about 15 hours, which is 10 times around the world. Imagine... If you could, if for part of your life you'd been holding on to the outside of a spaceship with one hand long enough to go around the world 10 times, and where there's nothing between you and the universe but the layer of plastic of your visor. You can turn your head in one glance, take in half of the world, and then you look the other way, and there's the rest of the universe. And we sort of have a comfort that you take for granted, like being a little kid holding on to your mom's leg, the comfort of sitting on the earth looking up at the universe. There's a great solidity and sense of place when you just look up at the universe. When you're out on a spacewalk, you and the world are separate entities. You're going through the universe, around the sun, with the world. It's entirely different, and that is palpable within you. And you're linked to the spaceship, but only by the thinnest of wire. Like there's a clothesline, a thin one, attaching you to the space station. Really, it's just what's in the palm of your hand, holding on to one little handrail.
Can you allow your – forgive me for interrupting this, but can you allow yourself to even think about that when you're out there?
It's too late to think about that out there. You have to understand at a really deep and trusting level way before you get there at all of the mechanics of it and the risk of it and the procedures of it. And I spent a huge amount of my life getting ready for it, more than anybody will ever know. And the beauty of doing that, the beauty of I know how the wire is melded together and braided and then sealed so that I know that my cable and how the clip on the end is attached and all of the procedures and everything, just so that's not what's in my mind while I'm there, because you should be completely free to absorb what's happening when you're there. You shouldn't be fretting about stuff that is kind of the compulsories. You should be ready for the freestyle of the experience.
Well, therein lie lessons for life, and you talked about sort of being in one sense now finally tethered to the universe. That you can sense in some ways, I have the sense of being part of it, a very Zen kind of message, and I understand that your book, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, has actually been the grist of sermons now, right?
It is, yeah. That really surprised me. I got contacted by pastors in various locations. One of them didn't even contact me. One of my folks found it on the web of this whole series of sermons. But just the idea of the book was a spacewalk is fascinating. It's a new perspective as a human being to see the world that way, but also to be in a position maybe to see the universe that way and our place in it and an initial sense of what it's going to be like to turn our tail towards Earth and leave. We're just starting to get a sense of that. It makes a nice story, but so what, right? I mean, what is there in that has anything apart from an interesting thought experiment? And I wanted to look at it from everybody's point of view and see what it is that might be of use when I'm talking out of school. I don't want kids to come away just thinking they saw a juggler or a flame eater. They should come away thinking, that was really cool, and he made me think about some stuff that I never thought of before. And that was the purpose of the book, was kind of the distillation of how do you get ready to do something that is almost impossible? How do you prepare yourself for something where the stakes are extremely high and the risk is high? How do you separate fear from danger in your life? Because so many people, they'll just say, I would never fly in an airplane. I'm afraid of flying. And I'm thinking, well, okay, but think of what you've just denied yourself in life. And what is it that you're actually afraid of? What, you know, it's easy to hide behind a fear, but if you dig into it, if you look at the actual danger, it can enable you to get to a place and see something that otherwise would narrow your entire existence without it. Mm. And so the book is a discussion of all of those ideas of how to conduct yourself through life to do things that are near impossible. And so I'm delighted that schools and churches and things have found the ideas of the book to be enlightening.
Big ideas with some great stories. All the technology and the metallurgy that goes into keeping you safe, it was a Swiss Army knife that got you back in the space station.
On my first flight, I was on Space Shuttle Atlantis, and our job was to help build the Russian space station Mir back 20 years ago. On my very first flight, and I'd used the big robot arm, the Canadian built robot arm, and attached it as like a huge tunnel on top of the space shuttle, and then we drove the whole space shuttle up like we were balancing a huge broomstick and plugged it into space station Mir from below. Really complex thing to do, hard to control, but we got successfully docked. But now need to equalize pressure and then open the hatch, and I floated down to the hatch. And some extremely exuberant and safety-conscious Russian engineer, he had tied up that hatch with more batting and straps and tape and all sorts of things that no one had told us about. And, like, it's time to get the hatch open. I couldn't – and so popped out my Swiss Army knife and started – cutting all these cables away and pulling things and undoing screws and little strands. And my brother is a big – growing up on a farm, big Swiss Army knife guy. I remember halfway through it, I turned around and smiled at the camera and held up the Swiss Army knife just for my brother, just to say, hey, look where I am and what I'm doing. And the Russians are on the other side, you know, pounding on the hatch and looking through the window, waving at me, and eventually popped the hatch open and went into Mir.
Please tell me it was gaffer's tape that you had to cut through, because that's so MacGyver.
Oh, yeah. Just cool. A whole mixture of all different types of tape. Yeah, it was an international break and enter for sure.
Okay, I got time for one more question, and that is about international. Well, lots of talk about being on Mars in 2018. I mean, two questions. I don't know. How plausible is it that we'll be on Mars soon? But maybe the bigger question is, do you see international space colonization? Do you think, not international, intergalactic, space colonization as the kind of human destiny?
We have started international space colonization, of course. The International Space Station, we've had people there, including at least one American, for the last 14 and a half years. We left Earth on a permanent basis almost 15 years ago, and that is our first toehold of colonization. And it's been hard and unnatural. You know, those countries, Russia, Japan, Germany, United States, Canada, all of Europe, they've got lots to argue about historically and even current day. But meanwhile, we're also actually doing this thing. And I think it's a wonderful example in amongst all the day-to-day crap that's normal on the surface here. And it's not going to suddenly stop. We've always explored, found a place that's interesting or useful to us, and then pushed the best of our technology to allow us to live there. It's how North America got settled 20,000 years ago and 500 years ago. It's how Antarctica got settled 100 years ago, and we've been in space for 50 years. And we will go from the space station, maybe another 15 years on the space station. We'll go from there to the moon next, because it's only 3 days away. And we don't want to kill everybody for the first 15 tries. You know, we need to have some options. And eventually we'll go to Mars. We're not going to Mars in 2018 or anything. That's all just kind of fun discussion. But eventually we will. And it's just a matter of the small boy imagination and then the huge amount of work that can turn that into reality and then all the things it teaches us.
Well, I hope we take all the lessons of what can go wrong in colonization forward as we advance.
As do I.
Chris Hadfield, what a pleasure. Thank you for talking with us.
Thanks. Nice to talk to you.
Chris Hadfield is one of the most seasoned and accomplished astronauts in the world. His book, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, now out in paperback, going to be at Quail Ridge Books, reading and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock. Just ahead, two Methodist ministers talk about LGBT rights on the state of things. Stay with us.
Major Tom.